You're listening to Radio Berkman from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. You can find show notes for this episode and more programs like this at blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman.
Did you hear the news? I'm going to make records.
No kidding!
If you ever think of the idea of ethnomusicology, you're probably going to be thinking of people like John and Alan Lomax, folklorists and archivists who traveled the world recording and collecting the songs and sounds of dozens of cultures in the 1930s and 40s. Behind me, you can hear a song the Lomaxes collected in 1939 from a prison chain gang. You might think the job of collecting and tracking musical trends these days would be much, much easier with new technology. After all a researcher would have to do is fire up YouTube or MySpace and see what's bubbling up among self-producing musicians. But it's harder to track worldwide musical trends than you might think. Wayne Marshall is an ethnomusicologist, blogger, DJ, and a postdoctoral scholar at MIT, working on a book about global youth culture and digital music. He's coined a new term, world music, that's W-H-I-R-L-E-D music, the idea of international musical trends enabled by the net that merge all kinds of musical traditions and emerging trends, creating musical hotspots around the world and online. This is distinct, but an evolution from world music, that's W-O-R-L-D world music, a marketing term that arose out of the 1980s as a way to promote music that was simply not Western pop music. Wayne Marshall sat down not long ago with Ethan Zuckerman of the Berkman Center to talk about what these terms mean and why they are important.
Well, I've been riffing around this idea of world music, sometimes spelling it in this W-H-I-R-L-E-D way, as a way to underscore the degree to which we're talking about hybrid sounds, about fusing genres and styles and so forth. But I want to hold on to this idea of world music too, because I think there are some interesting ways in which that concept that most of us know from the sort of some industry marketing ventures of the 80s and 90s have, to what extent that's being revised in this digital world, and especially by young people who aren't necessarily so tied to traditional signposts of their local cultures, but are, you know, taking random walks on YouTube and that sort of thing.
Let's unpack sort of what that history of world music is. When does that term come into use? When do we encounter it for the first time?
There was a sort of emerging idea about this notion of world music as something that described the music of the non-Western world. It was sort of being put together over the course of the 60s and 70s, oftentimes by ethnomusicologists who were going out in the so-called field and doing field recordings, usually of traditional music, and then oftentimes collaborating with record labels like Nonesuch or Smithsonian and issuing these documents. Generally, they were classed under everything from primitive music to traditional music to more specific labels. And alongside those efforts, there were also, you know, small fledgling record labels who increasingly were issuing more popular music from these places. And it was in 1987 that a consortium of record labels got together in London and decided that they really needed a sort of coherent label in order to market their wares more effectively in record stores, back when we had record stores. There was an agreement that world music and other things were suggested, tropical music, hot music, all kinds of sort of usual suspects in a way for the way that world music ended up getting marketed, were tossed out, but world music was decided on. And so since about 1987 or so, there have been some successful, you know, attempts to market this idea of music from elsewhere, music from the non-Western world, under that term. And I think that's how most of us understand it now, though perhaps the contemporary signposts are more something like Putumayo or, you know, world music, the label itself, that kind of thing.
For those of us who are sort of perhaps used to thinking of world music as ooh, look, someone's just discovered this guy named Bob Amal. Isn't he interesting? Let's pay attention to him. You're talking about something pretty different when you're talking about sort of brave new world. And you've even at some point sort of thrown out a controversial, and I think when you raised it, intentionally provocative term, but actually which is maybe more descriptive of the sort of music that you're fascinated by, but you threw out the term global ghetto tech. Do you want to unpack that for us?
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack in there. Well, so there are sort of two layers to this world, and this gets us into the idea of uneasy peers. On the one hand, we have a lot of young people who are just making music, making dance videos, and sharing them with their peers. Now, notably, very often with their directly local peers. Of course, it just so happens that these platforms that they're using, whether it's YouTube, iMeme, so forth, are public by default, right? So they put this video on there. It might be for their high school classmates, but it can circulate globally. And so there's a sort of another set of peers, if you will, if we're thinking in the more peer-to-peer technology sort of notion, where you know, bloggers from halfway across the world might pick up on that. And so I started to note a sort of constellation of blogs that were very interested in this new music bubbling up from all kinds of places, generally the urban centers of not just the global south or the non-Western world, but all over the world. Although some of them were using this idea of world, more of them were interested in the term global as opposed to world. I think world music is still seen as maybe their parents' music or something like that. But also that the sort of the old signposts of kind of musical difference, the traditional, right, had been replaced by an interest in the music of the world's ghettos, in a sort of in the kind of urban signifiers. So music that was very engaged with hip hop, reggae, electronic dance music more generally. And I started to see that although ghetto tech, it's actually a specific term that refers to a local dance style that comes out of Detroit, it had started to become loosed from that term, in part because, you know, it's a drop-down option on MySpace and that kind of thing. And so I started to see increasingly, whether it was a flyer for a party or a banner on a blog, that this term global and ghetto tech were that these terms were sort of coalescing in a certain way.
I know that some of our listeners are going to want you to put your DJ hat, or I guess your phone's on for a moment here. So give us three tracks that the average Berkman listener will be able to find online. Tell us how to find them, and tell us what you think is interesting about them, as sort of explaining this brave new world that you're exploring.
Well, I think one example that I like is a track called Yabba Dabba Doo, that was produced by some Dominican kids, and it's not always clear whether that's happening in the Dominican Republic or it's happening in New York. Now, Yabba Dabba Doo, also sometimes you can find it with the search term jerk bow, so J-E-R-K-B-O-W. And that itself is already sort of marking a kind of worldness, W-H-I-R-L-E-D, in that it's a concatenation of jerkin, which a genre I've already named, a kind of sub-style of hip-hop that grew out of Los Angeles in the last year or two, and dembow, the sort of Puerto Rican term for a Jamaican rhythm that has been really foundational in reggaeton. Jerk bow is doing something else, though, in that it's actually less centered in Puerto Rican reggaeton than it's centered in a genre called Dominican dembow, where Dominican producers have remained very enamored of the 90s style of reggaeton. In the 90s, Puerto Rican producers were very freely sampling from contemporary hip-hop and reggae and really creating their own thing, but based out of very recognizable samples. And that was doable in part because it was underground music. They actually very often called it underground when they weren't calling it dembow. And that was marking an aesthetic position, but also a market position, and one that had afforded it a certain amount of creative freedom. And in the Dominican Republic, they've continued to do this, oftentimes by continuing to sample the same sort of well-worn and well-loved samples that were being used by Puerto Ricans in the 1990s. Part of that has been a kind of audible embodiment of, on the one hand, sounds that are heard as Dominican or as Caribbean, and on the other hand, sounds that are heard as modern and global. And so in this case, Jerk Bow, what they're doing is merging this dembow sound that has been very naturalized as Dominican, despite being a strange mediation of Jamaica via Puerto Rico, and jerkin, which is seen as, you know, new global youth culture. If you search for this on something like YouTube, you can find a variety of instantiations where it's not just an official video, it's that this track itself has circulated as audio, and then other kids have decided to do a dance to it, right? And so there again, it becomes hard to sort of isolate the text too. You know, where does Yabba Dabba Doo reside? Is it on this video instantiation? Is it on this one? Is it the audio? The other thing I would say, and not necessarily a specific track, but if you look for tribal, now this is a relatively sort of recent emergent genre out of Mexico, and you can find quite an amazing variety of tribal productions on something like YouTube, which has become not just the de facto sort of video archive for the world, but audio as well. So you'll find people posting their tracks or posting their mixes of a bunch of tribal tracks. And what you hear in tribal is this really wonderful mix of, on the one hand, you know, again, musical signifiers that are heard and felt as local, things from cumbia and other kinds of Mexican popular and traditional music. And on the other hand, everything from, you know, reggaeton samples to contemporary techno to hip-hop, to just, you know, internet memes that these same kids are finding as they're sort of wandering around YouTube. I guess if I were to offer a third example, it would again be more of a genre term to search out, which is Moomba tone. So Moomba, M-O-O-M-B-A-H, refers to a song that was produced by a Dutch producer of house music. But it's called Moomba tone in that a Washington, D.C.-based DJ decided to slow down this Moomba track and to play it at reggaeton speed, and in the process sort of really transforming the sound and making it quite palatable to the party that he was playing, which was some local Latino kids, and I guess some buddies of his cousins who were cutting school one day and dancing to it. But this idea really caught fire and inspired a lot of other tracks. In particular, this a young producer from the Netherlands, but of Dominican descent, a guy who calls himself Munchi, M-U-N-C-H-I. And he's just been utterly prolific in taking this idea and using the kind of basic aesthetic template to also sort of route through it all of his own favorite genres. So he's used it as a very flexible platform and as a way of sort of reviving for him reggaeton, but also bringing in things like bachata or mambo or funk carioca or bubbling or, you know, any kind of other genre. That's another great example of this new world, where there's all sorts of things mixing and a lot of vibrancy, a lot of production, and it's really something to behold.
If we think of this sort of historically, you and I both grew up at a time where it was about the record store. And, you know, if you happen to be lucky enough to have a record store where the proprietor periodically went to Japan or Germany, you had access to a whole other collection of music that no one had. Now, you know, you can be a suburban kid in Boston and, you know, Techno Brega is a couple of clicks away and something that you might end up randomly stumbling upon, which is a function both of, as you mentioned, the easy recording and also the easy access to it. What does this sort of global web of signifiers where Detroit techno and, you know, whatever's new in the streets of Sri Lanka are all sort of equally accessible on these platforms, what is it doing to people as listeners, and what is it doing to people as creators of music?
One thing that I see as a kind of an optimistic sign, again, vis-a-vis this older concept of world music, is that if we see this as a kind of new world music circulation, there's a way in which it's been decentered, right? So the old premise of world music was that there was a rest and there's a west and a rest, right? And the fact that Ghetto Tech or Jit from Detroit or Juke from Chicago or Jerkin from L.A. circulates alongside Kuduro from from Angola, or Tecnobrega from Brazil and so forth, suggests that there's a kind of new sense of world, of a kind of decentered world, where it's not necessarily about a sort of centrally placed Western consumer going outward, but instead it's about a more free-floating set of signifiers. And so there's a way in which maybe we're seeing a revised idea about where we draw those lines between us and them, between here and the world. What does that do for listeners? I mean, I think it does. There are ways in which, whether it's a serendipitous encounter on YouTube or it's going to, a blog run by a DJ that you like, who typically is talking about things more familiar, but then suddenly introduces, a sort of global variant on hip-hop or reggae, there are ways in which people's cultural horizons are broadening in that way. And to a certain extent, I think, like old world music, it can foster a curiosity and an interest in that place. One of my concerns about it, though, and this is why I sort of introduce global ghetto tech as a kind of snarky way of talking about it, is that sometimes the engagement doesn't go that deep, that it stays at a sort of surface level. There's often a kind of litany of genres, and that you just move from one to the next, right? There's a sort of this is the new foreign. And it seemed like a kind of flavor of the month thing, as opposed to a more sustained engagement. This actually got me thinking about some of the concepts that you've thrown out on your own blog, the question of sort of bridge figures and the need for translation in a certain way. One of the things that's conspicuous in some of this is the sort of lack of those figures in a way. And that's in part because this stuff can travel without those intermediaries, right?
Well, I wonder if this is if this is in fact why music often ends up being sort of the absolute bleeding edge of what comes up in the digital world. So you can trace WikiLeaks in a weird way back to Napster.
Right.
Once you have digitized music, music goes everywhere. And eventually anything else that you've digitized also goes everywhere. And it's very, very hard to keep, the cat in the bag.
Right.
But music, precisely because you don't need to translate it, mm-hmm. you can often enjoy it without necessarily understanding the deeper meaning behind it. I think a lot of the work of someone like Pippa Norris, who basically says, look, there's basically four things that can happen when cultures come together. One can conquer the other. American culture just wipes everything out. It's all McDonald's. You can basically react to one and sort of say, I'm against this. You can have the jihadist, get it away from me. You can do the fusion side of it and essentially say, hey, all right, let's put my spice in your food and we'll end up with curry and it'll be great. Mm-hmm. She says what happens most often is you sort of look at it, you nod, you say, that's interesting, thanks, I'm going to do my own thing. Music seems to be one of these places where historically we've done the third thing, where fusion is almost the easiest thing to do. What do these sort of emerging fascinations, these emerging fusions, what does a figure like Diplo tell us about not just the future of music, but possibly the future of media in a net age?
It does draw us back to this question of platforms and unstable platforms in a way. And I've seen this Napster comparison to WikiLeaks come up a few times. And it helps to affirm, a lot of times people say, well, you're an ethnomusicologist, what does that have to do with media or politics or that kind of thing? And I do have a sense that music does operate at the bleeding edge of culture in a certain way and tests a lot of technologies and so forth. We've seen that, of course, over the last decade, especially with regard to peer-to-peer file sharing. But we see it also at the level of experimentation, of cultural combination and innovation and so forth as well. A lot of what I've been observing with regard to this new, brave new world of music is how much it is sort of dependent on these platforms. And in lots of ways, we might see some of these so-called viral, you know, dance crazes as canaries in the coal mine for what we're now observing with regard to WikiLeaks, that what we think of, or what we come to think of as a sort of public conversation being staged on the internet, whether we're seeing that conversation proceed in discursive terms or in, you know, in exchanged songs and dances and so forth, actually these aren't as public spaces as we think, right? And so the some of the disappearing videos that I've been watching, or in fact the entire platforms, iMeme and Jamglue are two of these platforms where they were clearly fostering and facilitating quite a bit of exchange and so forth, and then suddenly
pause for a moment and talk about iMeme specifically, which of course MySpace notoriously bought and killed. But what was so great about iMeme and what was happening in that space that you're sort of now, I think, rightly mourning?
Right. So iMeme, for those who don't know it, I mean, we might call it an audio YouTube. It was a Flash-based site where people could upload audio, and then it could be streamed, it could be embedded, it could be shared, and so forth. And iMeme was actually distinctive insofar as it actually negotiated licensing terms with the major major music companies, knowing that would be a thorn in its side. And they had to do that because the fact is, you know, if they opened it up to users to upload whatever they wanted, sure, plenty of users were uploading independently produced tracks, self-produced tracks, and so forth. And others were using it to share, you know, to share pop culture, just as YouTube gets employed as well. They had to negotiate those licenses, and they did. But I think that they found over time that they actually weren't able to monetize appropriately. These deals they'd worked out, they couldn't actually get the page views or the ad money or whatever it was to pay off these contracts. So eventually they got embroiled in a legal, in some challenges, in particular by one record company, which was not the major one of the major record labels that left them in such a hamstrung state that they could be sort of scooped up by MySpace, apparently for under $1 million. This was important to MySpace because they saw that iMeme had 16 million users and that it was a fairly vibrant platform for sharing and conversing and all of that metadata underneath, all of the user-generated data about who people are and their profiles and their tastes and so forth. And that was interesting to MySpace. And that was something that MySpace wanted to transport to their own sort of faltering site. What actually didn't get transferred, though, was all of the self-produced tracks and all the independent produced tracks. Sure, MySpace had their own licenses with these major companies. So if you had those tracks on your profile, you could then have them on your MySpace music profile. But anything that they didn't have just went poof in a way. And so I watched as these entire sort of virtual communities gathered around something like Chicago Juke or like Trinidadian Soca and so forth. Those just disappeared one day, very suddenly. Jamglue is another example. I mean, essentially the same story all over again. But, you know, you could go there and type in a search term like Jerkin or like Juke, these genre names that are generally working in a kind of non-commercial realm. Some of these artists sign record deals and enter into the world of commerce, but most of it is essentially non-commercial. It's a kind of thing that people are producing for themselves and for their peers. And you could do a search for one and find hundreds and hundreds of tracks and remixes based around these. But in part because those aren't so easily monetized, they don't last.
Do you think we're on the verge of a shift in how sort of people think about remix culture and about cultural ownership? I mean, on the one hand, you know, the iMeme story is basically a very sad story about the independence and the self-produced disappearing in the face of the major labels. But, Greg Gillis just released a Girl Talk album, and I heard it featured on three different NPR shows, and no one asked him, is this music legal? You know, can this music be distributed? And it was sort of mentioned that it was free, but essentially, you know, I think 5 years ago the story would have been a completely illegal album, you know, is making waves. And now it's sort of like the assumption is this appears to be a new musical form. Yes, we understand that it's sort of challenging. Do you think at some point we're going to see someone else come up with a platform or a structure that acknowledges that one of the ways in which music, and as you're helpfully pointing out, world music is made, is about this sharing of influence, this remixing, putting things out that don't necessarily have a commercial market?
Yeah, I mean, I think on the one hand, we can recognize, even without again, without talking about the legality of it, that remix has become a kind of cultural dominant. That with these digital tools, with cut and paste so easily available, and of course with longer standing cultural practices that had to do with revision and allusion and reuse, hip hop and reggae are worth teasing out in that way because they've both also sort of helped to contribute those ideas, the idea of reusing other things, and to sort of amplify those methods in a way. But yeah, I think we're seeing this as just what people do, how people make culture today. And so it does, you know, there may be a moment where we see a broader sea change, and where we don't see the sort of disappearance as the other side of the coin here. I think that, you know, a site like YouTube, though it has to walk a sort of careful line between, you know, not incurring the wrath of a Viacom and on the other hand, not alienating its huge base of users, is trying to work out ways that this kind of reuse can be monetized. And so now you're more likely to see, you know, a kid dancing to a sample-based beat and then the Amazon link for buying the original pop up than for that whole video to just disappear. So it's getting worked out, you know, willy-nilly. There are some casualties in the process. But yeah, on the other hand, I mean, I just think that's where we are now as far as how culture is made.
Thanks very much for being with us at Berkman and sharing this picture of the new world.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Wayne Marshall is an ethnomusicologist, blogger, DJ, and a postdoctoral scholar at MIT working on a book about global youth culture and digital music. You can find out more about his work and find links to the music used on today's show at our website, blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. The Rethink Music Conference is coming up very soon, from April 25th to the 27th in Boston. If you've enjoyed this conversation, you might want to think about showing up. You can find out more at rethink-music.com. This episode of Radio Berkman was produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, with Wayne Marshall and Ethan Zuckerman from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts.